All right, so I've been waiting about, I apologize for my voice. I've been waiting about, I don't know, five or six months or actually probably a year since I did my last class on poetry, and now I've got a captive audience, so I get to talk about my favorite subject. So this is great. I'm pretty happy right now. So, let's start with this question of what is poetry? Right? I mean, when you read people like Shelley and Schiller, I mean, it's very hard to define poetry. Right? But I mean, we can put a few thoughts out there, and you guys can also contribute a few. But I would start by submitting to you, poetry is the expression of the imagination. This is one thing. Right? What else is poetry? As Shelley said, it is vitally metaphoric. Also. Right? Yep. You got some
words for expressing.
I remember the last poetry class, I had a bunch of jackasses sitting in the back talking a lot of shit.
That's why I'm here to keep them going.
All right, excellent. I'll probably be calling upon you. All right. What do people think anyway? What do they think about when they think of poetry or the role of poetry? Yeah, drama traditionally was in verse, yeah.
I think about Schiller. Like the artist, it's the last one I read with Ivan when he went down to the webcast.
The idea I'm thinking about with classical Latin in general is the question of how much do you communicate the thought object to someone? Like, you can't use literal language. Like, through poetry, like, most of it is like poems, it's nothing like that. It's how in which can you take someone through a discovery? How can you get someone to form a specific thought object in their head? How can you express multiple things at the same time?
Yeah.
Not having that kind of relation with something new, but when you read something.
That's interesting. Yep.
I'd say it's also just the process of educating someone about the true nature of man, in the sense that they're put in a position where they have to use their creativity to hypothesize as to what the person is trying to have them discover.
I think poetry is used when you want to talk about something that is not, let's say, like a car.
Okay.
Because the thing is, why I use that image is because a car is physical and people can touch it and can understand the gears and the mechanics of it. But usually when you're writing good poetry, it's about something which is not really something you could put your hand on.
I'd also say that poetry participates in the eternal and is universal in scope. In the sense that when a poet create something, right? Say a simple nature scene, right? Where you're looking at something and you see something profound and beautiful that's occurring in the world. Now, if you think about time, sorry, just a second. I have some water here. Anyway, when you think of time. Right, I mean, this moment that that you see before you, when does it exist? or how does it exist, right? How long does it last? It lasts but a moment, right? An infinitesimal, right? In a world of constant change.
Wait, so what are you saying? When you think of time, something
time, yeah.
Okay.
Or an experience. Right, when a poet composes a poem, they compose it about perhaps an experience or an idea or a thought, right, or something that's occurred in the universe, which is a transient experience. Right, but poetry has the capability to bestow immortality upon that experience or that idea, which is something to consider. Because time, and if you read Augustine, I think it's book 10 or 11, he discusses this concept. And where he comes to the conclusion that this idea of immortality is really within the human mind and through memory, right? And that nothing actually exists. Just as Plato says, you have a world of becoming and a world of being. Right, and poetry, in a sense, exists and is a conduit to that world of being. Right, where you can capture a moment which is passing as soon as you capture it. Right, but with every reading, that moment is reborn. So with that, now another way to look at poetry is also to consider what it's not. Or to look at what some people call poetry and consider whether it actually is. So if we could flip one of the panels here. Okay, next one. What is poetry? That's what we're looking at here. All right. One more.
That's pretty poetic.
Does somebody want to read this?
What is it?
Yeah, I'll read it.
Well, I left the names of all the examples of that I'm using. None of them have names. We can talk about that afterwards because I don't want to bias people before they read it. So I'm being tricky here. So if somebody wants to read that, that'd be good.
The winter evening settles down. The smells of steaks and patty wings. 6 o'clock. The burnt-out ends of smoky days. And now a gusty shower wraps the grimy sprats. And withered leaves about your feet, and newspapers from vacant lots. The showers beat, and broken blinds and chimney pots. And at the corner of the street, a lonely cab horse steams and stamps. And then the lighting of the lamps.
Is that more, or is that it?
That's it.
That was pretty painful.
I guess
it's a twisted mind which must have come up with that.
Probably somebody who won a prize. Just the Canadian,
Yeah, I don't know. Suicide clinic or something. So, well, what do people think about this? Is this a poem or what? Any thoughts on this? Mm-hmm. What does it catch you in any way, or does it? What kind of response do you have to this?
It rhymes.
Yeah, it rhymes sometimes, yeah.
Same
I guess it rhymes, yeah.
Sounds like Baltimore.
Sounds like Baltimore, yeah. Hmm.
Well, it's not.
But it looks like it's in verse, so I guess it must be a poem.
It's not very uplifting.
No. No, it's not really. Withered and broken and...
chimney pots.
Grimy, gusty, burnt out ends. The smell of steaks.
What do people think he's trying to say? Not wrong. What kind of photo of it could we communicate?
I think it's nothing but just scrolling the scene of the back alley type.
So we're all agreed at the bottom.
Yeah. Let's,
it's not going to work.
No.
The audience,
so. Okay.
We're off.
Okay, sure.
The plot, right.
Maybe I'll read this stuff from now on because it's not going to pick up unless the person wants to come up to the front. Okay, well, yeah, actually, you can come up because we'll have. All right, let's go to the next piece. Well, just think about this in terms of what we're going to look at later.
You want to read that one? For the
no, it's
one?
Okay. We'll save the
all right.
The ears of anybody. Now, yeah, do you want to read this one?
You want me to go up?
Yeah, sure, you can come up with it.
The scientific revolution winds down. Mechanistic physics, your body a clock, your dark arms ticking down the time as though the round white face of the moon was built by human hands. To see this clearly is to see a tiny bowl behind the brain that holds the thought of size and shape and lights up when we touch. You can be the well-oiled gear. I'll be the stick tossed into your gleaming. I'll be the heart behind the workbench, slowly descending to rust.
That's not a poem.
That was Shakespeare, wasn't it?
You got me. This was his early days.
What's supposed to be poetic about that?
Well, that's a good question.
Like, there's absolutely no... There's not even, like... I mean, it doesn't even... Like, some people could maybe get, fogged by the fact that things rhyme. So they think it's poetry because it rhymes or whatever, or there's, like, a poetical format. This doesn't even have that. It doesn't even rhyme.
It doesn't have anything.
So this is
modern poetry. This is contemporary... You know, the person who wrote this last year, won the Canadian the CBC Literary Awards. This poem was part of a collection that won $6,000. Yeah, first prize, publication, interview on CBC, stuff like that. I looked at it, Rachel, the other day. I showed her a little bit, and man. Horrible stuff. We agreed on that pretty quick, right? But all of it's like that, right? It's about 1,000 words of sheer, it's nothing. It's filth.
What about the first one?
The first one? The first one was T.S. Eliot.
Oh, okay.
At least he rhymed, right?
Well, I noticed Eliot at least was able to paint a picture in mind. This one doesn't.
Yeah, it was a psychotic picture, but. Yeah, well, this just, I think, is indicative of the degeneration of the culture in general, in terms of what... See, you had a whole, and this goes back, we talked earlier about Aristotle, that there's been an intentional destruction of the use of metaphor in poetry, right? And there's a book, Seven Types of Ambiguity, and at a certain point, I can't remember the name of the fellow who wrote that, but he's remarking upon the Enlightenment poets, people like Donne and Alexander Pope and people like this in Britain, that they tried their hardest to never use metaphors, never use any kind of ambiguous language. And if they used it, it was by accident. And if they knew they had done it, they would have eliminated it from their poetry. They would have corrected it. Right, they were. So the thing is, you have this kind of resurgence of, poor taste, again, basically, in contemporary poetry. Right, so that's what we're dealing with today, and that's what wins prizes. But classical composition will be tossed in the gutter. All right, let's go to the next slide.
Can I read this one?
Well, if you can. I'm not sure if it's... Love a leaf falls onlyness.
Oneness.
Oh, yeah, that's profound. Look, in loneliness you have one. Oh, man.
Then you have I-ness.
That poet was astute. So, is that a poem?
Is that just like a puzzle or something?
No, that's... They call that automatic surrealism.
Mm.
Like, in terms of poetry, where in which you just write, and then it comes out of
the... Oh, yeah, stream of consciousness, and they have a name for that too, yeah.
Huxley's daughter.
Yeah. That was a very... Anybody want to guess who wrote that?
Cummings.
Your five years mother.
Yeah, Nietzsche.
That's a poem?
Yeah, it's a poem.
Okay.
That was published. No, I'm serious. That was probably.
How do you read it?
Well, you can't, in a sense.
So the CBC awarded $6,000 for the other one. How much did the BBC award for this one?
I'm not sure. Or the CCF, maybe.
The CCF, yes.
Can you read that out loud?
La a leaf falls onlyness. It's not really... See, the thing is, it was never intended to be read. There's other... I mean, Cummings writes other stuff where you can read it, but it's schizophrenic, basically.
Yeah.
Because he's destroying the language. He's destroying... He's throwing the grammar out the window. He's... yeah, he frees himself of all the rules, but in a sense, he, at the same time, eliminates the capability to convey ideas. Or there's this kind of funny paradoxical relationship between formalism and the ability to and freedom to express ideas, right? That people today say, well, it's like the democracy, right? I want to be free to do whatever I want. But that's not necessarily the best thing, right? Like when I ask people on the street, do you have the right to be stupid? Some people say yes.
Another good point with these guys, what they were doing is these poems, the only substance in them is communicating empiricism. It's communicating feeling state. This makes me feel good. This makes me feel bad. This makes me feel confused.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the idea in which that he's done with this is the same intention of people like Jacques Derrida and actually destroying cognition and destroying people's ability to change.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So we've gone through the bad and the ugly now. I think the next one will get a little taste of something different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now this is the first four lines. Now one of the things. well, I'll talk about it. Okay. So read the first four here. I sat and read Anacreon, an ancient Greek poet, moved by the gay, delicious measure. I mused that lips were made for love, and love to charm a poet's leisure. You want to hit it again? And as I mused, a maid came by with something in her look that caught me. You want to hit it again? Forgotten was Anacreon's line, but not the lesson he had taught me. Okay, so what's different about this than the other ones? This, by the way, is a Canadian poet that I discovered
on the way to Winnipeg.
On the way to, yeah, at Winnipeg. Yeah, but now, what is it? See, there's something that happens in the last couple lines, right? Where, because why is it that people have to laugh at that time? I mean, we could have just put those two lines by themselves and nobody would laugh. Nobody would get a,
well, it's like
get a little,
a joke.
You know? Yeah.
Like, it's like, it remembers you with the process, like what you read.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. None of them alone would make sense, but the whole gives you an effect.
Mm-hmm. So, from now on, the poems that we look at, we're going to look at it like that. We're going to take it a section at a time, because I think it's better that way to get a sense of how the poems are actually working to produce certain effects. Anacreon, he was an ancient Greek lyric poet. There's not that much known about him. But he wrote about love and different things. Leisure, ladies. That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure the... he lived around the time of Pisistratus in ancient Athens. So around... that was after Solon? Yeah. In like the 5th century... 5th or 6th century BC. So, alright, this is a little introduction thing there. So we get a sense of what bad poetry is, or if we want to deign to give it the title poetry. I don't think Shelley or Schiller would, or Keats. But now, we want to also look at this from a standpoint of science, right, and a certain rigor. I think we can move it forward, or we can just shut that down for a little bit now. We don't need that on. So, we're gonna start developing some of these ideas of the relationship between science and art, because Lynn talks about this a lot, And, you know, you get a lot of these arguments about, oh, the artsy-fartsies, and what are you doing teaching all of this crap in school? You know, we just got to have kids doing the math, whatever, you know, all this technical stuff to train them for their beast-like occupations in life. Right? But the thing is, there is a very important connection between the two. So now, since we have been working on Kepler recently, I wondered if somebody wanted to give a brief summary on what prompted Kepler, in brief, to his discovery. Actually, if they want to take a couple minutes to go through that a bit. Anybody? Okay. Because you had different systems at the time, right? You had the Ptolemaic system, you had the Copernican system, and you had Tycho Brahe's system. Right, and these guys are all presented with the same array of data, in a sense, right? The same sense perceptual evidence of something going on. Right, but Kepler actually has this a way of thinking. Right, and he's looking at the world around him, and he's looking at certain paradoxes which are being presented. You know, paradoxes between what we assume about the universe and how we assume the universe is functioning, and what the universe is actually telling us about how it's functioning. Right? So through a process that we're going through right now, Ryan's working with us on this kind of stuff. Kepler, through a series of hypotheses and different projects and many years of study, discovers a single unifying cause, right, which, in a sense, explains the motions of all of the planets. Right, whereas these other systems were inventing myriad causes, right, for all of the different phenomena that they were seeing. So this is now what Kepler discovers is an actual principle, a physical principle of the universe. Right, and he thinks of it like an idea. Right, an idea in the mind of God, or the creator of the universe. Right, that is ordering certain motions and certain phenomena which we are perceiving, but we don't actually see the principle itself. Right, this is very strange for a population of the time that would come up in, you know, grown up in an Aristotelian education system. Right, these people, because of the way they were thinking, they were incapable of actually discovering gravitation. Right, but Kepler was, because he had a different way of thinking. Now, so you have this capability demonstrated by man to discover these invisible principles. Now, you also have Vernadsky, very interesting guy, who actually looks and starts defining the universe in terms of a process, right? And LaRouche has picked up on this, the idea of a self-developing universe, right? Where you have a series of principles, in a sense. There's a principle governing abiotic life. Right? Now, there's also a principle of life, which is actually of a higher power than non-life alone. Then you have a principle of cognition, which is actually of an even higher order power than life and non-life. Right? So let's think about that for a second. So you've got a series of connected principles which are capable of being discovered by the human mind. Now, when you think about science, and you think about history and the technology we've developed, you have a series of discoveries, right? Individual discoveries like the universal gravitation, principle of least action, stuff like this, right, up to the developments in nuclear physics, right, and this is a series, and in a sense, one discovery, right, there's a certain sequence that these discoveries have to be made in, right, in order to get to nuclear, you can't have the principle of least action without Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation, or you can't have Kepler without the discoveries that Nicholas of Cusa made in terms of the first developments of a modern physical science. So these are it's an interrelated process. Now, is science any one particular discovery? Like, when we think of what science is, like, it's science is not universal gravitation, right? So what is science? Because science seems to be implied in a part of all of these different discoveries. But what is science itself? Any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, principles in general, whether it's rocks or physics or painting or poetry.
Okay, so it... like
investigation.
An investigation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that would be like the subsuming process of that that like changing from one one power to another, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Like with the example of Vernadsky, right? You have like this type of phase space, the biosphere, for example, that subsumes the abiotic, all of non-life. So all of living processes would then subsume the non-living.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd also have like the cognition,
mm-hmm.
state of cognition and the principle of fossil, if you will, of cognition brought by human life, which would subsume the biosphere. So these like subsuming phase spaces of a higher order of power over the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I think would be the the process of science.
Well, could you? So yeah. So we're defined science in a sense as a method of discovery, mm-hmm. which would now if you think of each of these individual discoveries as in a sense a single hypothesis, is science not? From Plato's standpoint, anyway, the higher hypothesis. And that in that process, which, in a sense, you have a principle of discovery, which is, in a sense, includes or is found in all of these individual discoveries. Right? That is actually generating these discoveries. Right, obviously by the application of the human mind, right, and through certain methods of questioning and thinking about the universe itself, right. So then, of course, the fact that we are sitting here, standing here, reflecting upon this, right. Plato would say that that's hypothesizing the higher hypothesis, right. Actually, reflecting upon how we generate these. Discoveries are reflecting upon the process which generates the discoveries. Okay? So, when we think about science, that's what we want to think about. Now, we want to keep this in mind when we talk about poetry in a little bit. Now, one last thing I'd mention. You have an interesting tension between man and the I'll say the composer, right, in the tradition of Plato again. The composer of the universe, as Timaeus calls him. Right, and it's fitting since we're talking about poetry. Because you look at any given time in history, right, the number of principles that humankind has come to master is of a fixed number, right, which we could say is M. Right, the total number of principles which we have mastery of, which we can employ through technology, right, in art, stuff like this. Now, whatever that limit is, right, it poses certain questions or certain paradoxes of their own, right, because obviously this number of principles we know is not the total number of principles. So our concept of the universe is going to come into conflict with the actual universe, just as it did with Kepler. Right, where certain things are going to be paradoxical to us, because we don't understand why they're happening. Certain events that are occurring are contradicting how we assume that the universe works. Okay? But now, obviously, if you're the composer, there's no conflict, right? There's no contradictions. It's like a smooth transition, in a sense, from one state to the next, or from one principle to another. They're all continuously connected, right? And there's no discontinuities. It's a continuous manifold, you'd say, right? Where everything's working in total harmony, and there's none of these weird events that you're seeing, right? The eye of the composer. There's nothing weird going on that you don't understand or you can't explain based upon all these ideas in your head. Okay? But man, we don't have that luxury. Right? So this is what sparks this. As Kepler says, you know, there's something about the universe which instills within us a profound sense of wonder and leads us to search for causes. Right? So there seems to be some connection between the composer and us and the universe itself. Right? And maybe it's better this way, right? Because we have a lot of things to figure out. So it would be boring if we knew everything already. Man, what would we do with ourselves? Just be like the Struldbrugs, right? Just baby boomers, just born to die. So again, in terms of science, a method of discovery is being the higher hypothesis, and then this tension between the composer's standpoint and man's. And Leibniz also, he mentions this in, I think, the introduction to New Essays on Understanding. That this is very important, these two concepts, when we look at poetry. So keep that in mind. And now I think we need to turn this back on, if you can, Val. Because now, I mean, in that poem that we saw about Anacreon, or that's called the Philander's Song, I think, the Womanizer's Song. Right, what you see there and what causes that kind of that spark at the end in that laugh is irony. Right, where something, the poem in a sense has kind of been turned on its head a little bit. Or something that's unexpected and yet lawful. Right, and that's the whole trick, is how do you do something that's unexpected yet lawful at the same time? So now, if you could move to the next slide. Might have to hit it again. Oh, and one more. Okay, so we're going to look at two sonnets. Okay, and we're going to examine these a little bit. So we're going to take them a piece at a time. I'll read this out. Is it thy will, thy image should keep open my heavy eyelids to the weary night? Dost thou desire my slumbers should be broken, while shadows, like to thee, do mock my sight? Any questions about that? We want to make sure that each time we've got a sense of, okay, what do we think? We want to make an hypothesis. Okay? So we can have a bit of a discussion around this, too. You know, people just throw things out. Who do you think he's addressing?
The sky?
The sky? Possibly.
This person, this possibly person.
Yeah, like when he's laying in bed and you've got shadows playing upon the walls. Let's go to the next Is it thy spirit that thou send'st from thee so far from home into my deeds to pry, to find out shames and idle hours in me, the scope and tenor of thy jealousy?
What's pry?
Pry is to poke your nose into somebody else's business.
Hmm.
Pry apart. You know?
Uh-oh.
Hmm. What do you guys think? Some connotations of some relationship here?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
The spirit could be what is shadowing in the first one, like which brings a shadow upon what he sees, or maybe upon a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody.
Well, shadows, I mean, that's a kind of bothersome, right? He doesn't seem like seems kind of agitated, maybe.
Yeah.
Like he's not really. It's not pleasant. Doesn't seem to be pleasant. The fact that he's talking about jealousy and prying into my deeds and
maybe it's a bad
shame and idle hours.
Bad energy's got,
Yeah, there's something.
Maybe he's a little bit. He's feeling this way because there's a little bit of guilt.
It's possible. Makes you wonder. Well, why is this person he seems to be talking about or something? I mean, so far from home.
He's paranoid.
Somebody
yeah,
far
he's
away.
He's a shadow. He doesn't know what the shadow is. It's like in this person. It's why they're in his room.
Yeah. Let's go to the next one. Oh no, thy love, though much, is not so great. It is my love that keeps mine eyes awake. Mine own true love that doth my rest defeat. To play the watchman ever for thy sake. So his own love is what's disturbing him, his own feelings.
Aww.
It's not some witch that's sending demons to plague him in the middle of the night.
I love you more than I love you more than you love me.
He's watching his own back. The idea of him watching.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's remaining skeptical.
Maybe he's sort of being defensive here, because previously it looks like he's paranoid that this person is going to find out something.
Yeah, that's possible. But what about this last line, to play the watchman ever for thy sake? Thy is like your
good?
Your sake.
Okay.
My love will keep me under control, perhaps.
Let's take a look at the last two lines.
Oh, oops, that wasn't it.
No.
That's why I was confused.
For thee watch I, whilst thou dost wake elsewhere, from me far off, with others all too near.
He's in love.
Yeah, I would say he's in love. But why? Hmm? Hmm.
He doesn't want to, like, go and, like... Oh! Having to
watch his own back because he knows what she's doing, or if he's removable, like, the other half's doing, having to, like, torture himself together. Huh. Oh, that... Huh. It's like, yeah, there's somebody for him which is really present in his head, but that present... nearby him, and there's somebody else which is really near from him, but not in his thought.
For thee watch I, whilst thou dost wake elsewhere.
Yeah, so I'm watching you while you're somewhere else. But I mean, in his mind, right? That's the shadows. Mm-hmm. Right, he's got these images in his mind, where that's all he's thinking about, and yet she's somewhere else, right? Far away from him, yet with others all too near.
At the beginning, is he talking about this other guy or his lover?
I think he's talking about the woman.
I thought that he was cheating on her. Because he said that, because he said thy jealousy, isn't that your jealousy?
Thy is yeah, the scope and tenor of thy jealousy, yeah.
Like your jealousy? Because he says to play the watchman ever for their sake, like he's watching his own back.
Yeah, well, it's like, are you? Well, like, my interpretation of the first eight lines is he's saying, you know, is it you that's sending these images to me to plague my nights, right, and keep me awake and keep me restless and thinking about you, and prying into my deepest thoughts and to find out what I'm ashamed of. But the scope and tenor of thy jealousy, I would take that to say that, you know, he's accusing, in the first part, accusing her, that this is your jealousy of trying to keep me, kind of thing, right? That you can be jealous of something in the sense of guarding it, right?
What's the scope, like, in
the scope, the extent. The extent and quality of your jealousy. He says, oh no! Your love, though much, is not that amazing. Right? It's me. And the fact that I'm continuously thinking about you being somewhere else and probably sleeping with somebody else.
This is one lovesick puppy. He doesn't know who to blame.
Now, this is a lot different than what we saw earlier, right? Way different. Yeah. Now, okay. So, keep this in mind. We're going to take a look at another sonnet. But you get a sense, right? As we went through this, there's a sense of change. Right? That when you, with each of these sections, something's being changed. Mm-hmm. But in a lawful way. Right, where it's consistent, and even at the end, right, where everybody is, ah, right, unexpected and yet lawful.
It's not schizophrenia, but the one about the
exactly.
Moon facing
yeah.
In the hands. And then
yeah, exactly. Since you want to think about the effect that the poet produced in us as we went through that. Now, the reason I like to go slowly like that is because it accentuates how he's doing it. And that's the key that we... Because I have a tendency, like I know when I read, I just... You flip through and you're already at the end. Then you've got that little ironic twist. And then you can go back and read it. But when you go through it a little bit slower like that, you appreciate much more profoundly what they're actually doing.
Well, it's like a joke. If you have the whole joke laid out before you with the answer there,
mm-hmm.
You read the whole thing and then the answer, and then
yeah,
it's not as funny as if you were to have the joke.
Mm-hmm.
You read it through and you feel the hypotheses in your mind
mm-hmm.
being developed and coming out, and then it's like the punchline. Well, give it, I want that mm-hmm. tension around, well, before those last two lines come up, well, the tension is like, this can't be finished, there's something that's unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And then it's like, oh, Mm-hmm. Any of you laugh or cry or whatever you want.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a look at another one of these and see how this next poet works with it. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon.
Where would be the meaning of sordid?
Sordid is like a dirty gift or a dirty advantage. Or soiled. Sounds like it could have been written in this day and age, but all right. So I think we got a sense of what he's. Send this to your average baby boomer. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at the next four. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. Pagan worship? Now that's funny. It's funny that you said that, and you'll see why in a second. So mankind has got himself all screwed up. All right. Next.
What's
one?
Sorted again?
Sorted is like a spoiled or soiled, dirty, degenerate.
If you were to give someone sorted advances, it would be like, in a sense, tempting them to dishonesty and something.
Mm-hmm. A sordid affair. Yeah, let's go. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan. Suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn.
What's a lea?
Think like a hill. Maybe a hillside by the sea. That's the sense that I get.
A lea is a hillside by the sea. Well, probably one.
That's a forlorn.
Hmm? Forlorn is sad, melancholy, yeah. Kind of in a lonely sense.
Man, you really picked a bunch of depressive.
Well, not completely. Don't worry, we got better stuff coming.
It's too elaborate. The ironical twist.
I want some more
A. Let's see the next two. Have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn.
Alright,
he's a sea god.
Yeah,
he's like a prince under Neptune. Triton's like the king of the mermen. The mer people.
Mermen.
The mermen. And the mermaids.
People with fish and tails?
Yeah. The mer people, sorry. Yes, that's right. We're in the politically correct age now. So, is this the same as the last one? What do you notice is different about this?
Well, there's not as much of a... I mean, there's no real process of change throughout the whole...
Mm-hmm.
There's no development like the last one.
Yeah.
Where we had a better sense and it was kind of mysterious and then there was an irony at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or it was like highly ambiguous. You know, the first one, but here it's kind of like more descriptive also.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you notice, I mean, the first eight lines, it's just the same basic thought that's being expressed, right? And then the last six is the same basic thought. But even then, this is pretty much just an extension of this, right? Nothing fundamental, there's no fundamental change in the poem.
Similar to that first.
Yeah.
It does something interesting with the poem.
Yeah, yeah, it rhymes and it's got meter and everything.
No, no, but I mean like the way.
Hmm?
Read it at once.
Sure.
Sometimes with a rhyming scheme, like that's a specific
mm-hmm.
rhyming
scheme,
it's really the whole thing.
Sure. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, are upgathered now, like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lee, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Hmm? The last two lines? He's just he's making references to various sea gods, you know, pagan imagery, basically. He's basically turning his back on civilization.
This doesn't communicate any sort of profound idea of change.
Right.
No.
It's just a nice story.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a nice work of fiction.
Yeah.
Just depressing.
Yeah. And quickly forgotten.
Sorry, what was it?
And quickly forgotten.
Sorry, what was it?
Bastard. Smart ass.
Ooh, I'm not gonna forget that.
Yeah. Mhm. So that's it.
In the next one?
Yeah, let's go to the next one. All right. We'll see how this one in a sense compares to the last one we looked at. It's true I've made mistakes along the way, as often as directly looked askance, or wandered here and there, and then astray, pulled everywhere by unreflecting chance. Hmm? Askance is to look sideways, or like out of the corner of your eye. As often as directly.
Where does the scant mean?
Scants. Scants means to the side.
So directly sideways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Out of the corner of your eye, kind of. Like when you want to look at something without being seen to be looking at it.
He's just going to look at it all.
Yeah,
let's go to the next one. And I suspect that you have known the same experience in this confusing wood, this wilderness that none shall ever tame, nor not, for lack of trying, understood.
Stuff that generally people in their life
mm-hmm.
Do you have poetry that you can relate to on that.
Mm-hmm.
You have poetry that actually brings you as a subject, as a reader, into
mm-hmm.
a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just sort of, I can reflect and go along. I understand this because I can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to actually being directly addressed by the poet.
Let's go to the next one. I could lament the troubles we had shared, the wasted time, the traps we should have seen, but foresight is to hindsight incompared, and in the end, 'tis for the best what's been. Hindsight? It's like, you know, we should have seen all this stuff, all of this, all these problems that, all stuff that we went through. But of course, to say that, you know, it's easy to say that looking back on what's happened, as opposed to when you're actually in the middle of things,
like
in medias res. Yeah.
Once it all crashed, it was crashing. I couldn't, we should have seen it.
Yeah.
Hyperinflation.
Yeah.
I think that he's addressing the question of like this idea of like the imperfection. Like, it's true, I've made mistakes. I bet you have too.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, even though you might think of the time as being wasted and all this stuff you could have seen, like,
mm-hmm.
you have to really look at it. What's happened is it's happened and you've actually learned from it.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. Let's go to the next. For all these wending ways which wayward drew have drawn me back more lovingly to you.
Did one of those prior lines change?
Nope. Hmm? Who wrote this one?
Yeah.
Me. Hmm? I had to throw one in there. So again, what you see in a successful one is in a sense the the poem generally gets in a sense turned on its head, right? Where you're continually having to reevaluate your hypotheses, right? Your previous hypothesis, right? And develop it, much like a scientist. And a successful poem will do this. So, what you're looking at, right, is if you think about these sonnets, for example, these four parts, what you're talking about essentially is like four hypotheses, right, of increasing power, right, because each new hypothesis subsumes the previous ones. Right, so you come closer and closer to the actual idea of the poem, but you don't actually reach it till the end. Then you have to go back and reevaluate the whole thing based upon the new evidence that you have and reevaluate the relationships between all of the parts.
What's lamenting?
lament is to is to like pine away or to feel sorry for yourself, to feel sorry about things that have happened.
Dwelling.
Sorry, what was that?
Like dwelling
upon something, maybe, yeah, like in sadness, or to be sad about things, like to lament somebody's death. There's no French poetry, always lamenting there's no French poetry,
no,
yeah. But that's understandable, you don't have much choice. Yeah, yeah, you could say that, yeah. Generally, it's something associated with loss. Right, to lament something, you lament a loss. Like when somebody's died or somebody leaves or whatnot. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, the Ave Verum changed the whole way I thought about poetry.
Yeah.
At that point. Mm-hmm. So, now, in a sense, in this question of overturning axiomatic systems, right, just as the scientists do, right, the great scientists, and this sequence of hypotheses, right, well, what, then, is the subject of poetry? Because we've looked at a lot of different poems that are all different. At least with the two or three good ones we looked at, they seem to share some characteristics.
Is this good?
I don't know. Yeah. You guys will have to judge that.
Never asked.
We'll talk about let's say the Shakespeare sonnet, okay?
Yeah,
as our frame of reference. Huh?
Like, how do you tell which ones are which?
Which ones are the good ones?
Because I can't tell. Like, I can tell, like, sort of what the idea is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but I don't get the language.
Yeah, the Shakespearean one. Shakespeare, I find generally a lot of the ambiguity is caused because of 500 years. Basically, a lot of it.
Literal speak back then.
Well, no, I mean it's very metaphorical, but a lot of the time the problems we have with the language, there are great problems. It takes a long time to get, or not. It takes a while to get a hang of Shakespeare, and even then. A lot of the meanings, but the language was richer back then too. But really, it's a question of judging the effect of the poem upon the readership. But what I would submit is that the idea of a poem corresponds to the higher hypothesis. Just as in science, the method of thinking of discovery, right, over a series of discoveries corresponds to the higher hypothesis. But now, in a sense, we got to ask this question, what is an idea? Because this is what, if we're saying that the subject of poetry is a higher hypothesis, the generating of an idea, which connects and unites all of these separate sections, right? If you think of them as being, from the standpoint of like discontinuities, right? They're literal discontinuities, because there's metaphors involved, there's ambiguities, right? It's not literal language. What is an idea? Any thoughts? How we would define an idea?
Depends on how you think of an idea.
Mm.
An idea like pipe and flavors type of idea.
Chopsticks.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of...
you read
yeah,
it.
What would... what do you guys say? Any ideas? Well, if you think of a universal physical principle as an idea, what is the power that principle has?
Change.
Yeah, it governs certain processes, right? Governs certain qualities of change, qualities of motion.
Changing man's relationship to the universe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they're discovered. For sure.
When they're acted on. Because you can make a discovery, that doesn't mean shit until you actually use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of poetry, I would say that the idea which governs the poem is, again, the equivalent of a universal physical principle in physical science. Because in the physical principle, where you have, in a sense, an idea of the universe, or of the composer, right, governing what is occurring physically, think of the words, right, as the sense perceptual sphere. Right, and the idea is what generates the particular words. Right, and I mean, it's in terms of poetry, there's never an arbitrary word in a poem. That's one thing, probably, and even the bad ones, well, you can't say that for sure, but yeah, in true poetry, there's no arbitrariness. Right, everything is governed by the idea. Right, in the poet's mind. But again, here, this is another correlation between the world of science and the world of art, of classical art. Right, where they correspond in this way. Right, so now how is poetry actually composed, right? I mean, in terms of this goes back to the tension between the composer of the universe and the scientist. Again, right? Where the poet and the reader approach the poem from opposite standpoints. For the reader, the poet has this moment of inspiration, right? Or this idea, this preconscious idea which forms in the mind, like this eureka kind of moment. That's what it's like, right? It's just all of a sudden it's there, and then it's fading immediately, right? But it's there, and you've got it. And then the thing is, when you write it, what you write, you don't know necessarily how it's going to unfold. It's like when Riemann talks about a Geistesmasse, right, a thought object. It's something that's vague and almost shapeless, formless in the mind, but it's there, and it has the power to actually determine what's going to come out on the page. So the poet has a sense of what is proper and what's not. So this is you think of the idea as an organizing principle, much as a universal physical principle, right, is governing the way the universe is unfolding. Right, the idea of the poem is also governing the way that the poem is unfolded in its development. Then you take the reader, who comes from the opposite standpoint, the standpoint of the scientist, right, who is actually experiencing the unfolding of the poem in order to get to the idea. The poet has it from the opposite side, has the idea first, and then unfolds the poem through the composition.
It's kind of ironic, too, that nothing in the poem is ambiguous in a good poem, but yet it's presented in a kind of ambiguous way until you get to the end.
Yeah, it's not ambiguous at all to the poet.
Right.
So, of course, then that brings up the question of, to actually write well, you have to be able to craft something which, even though it's not ambiguous to you, you know will be ambiguous in a lawful way to the reader, so that they will go through a process of discovery to come to the idea, the same idea in your own mind. Yeah, so that the true power of the poet is to generate the same thought object in their mind, in the mind of someone that they may never meet and may live 1,000 years after them. So when Shelley says that the poet exists, you know, with the eternal and the one, that's why he's saying that. Now, it's interesting to think, what is the actual emotional an intellectual state of the poet? What drives them to spend hours maybe anguishing over a single word? Right? And it happens. Yeah. Yeah, or being totally frustrated and getting all wound up because there's one thing that's just not quite right, you know, and you just, you don't know what it is yet. Sometimes it might take a couple weeks to come out. Sorry, something like that, right? Right, but I mean, what Shelley says and what I would also agree with is that the emotional and intellectual condition of the poet when he's composing classical poetry is agape, is pure agape. Because you think that it's not being written for him or for her, right? But for the people who will actually read it. Because there's a need within the poet to actually convey the idea which is developed in their mind. And we'll spend hours elaborating that idea through the poem in order to share that idea with others, with the intention of uplifting them. Through the sharing of those ideas. Right, so in the sense of creativity, that at that during that time of composition, and in particular in that momentary flash of insight or whatnot, that the poet, in a sense, becomes the embodiment of Imago Viva Dei. And then through the unfolding of the poem and the sharing of that with the readership, the reader, through that process of creativity, also experiences that emotional quality of Imago Viva Dei in the purest sense.
You want to try to say that?
The living image of God. Right, the act of pure creativity. So, in a sense, this idea, right, is leading the reader towards itself, right, through the poem. That's the power of these ideas, right? And what the reader ends up experiencing, and where this comes back again to the importance of science in a direct way, right, is that with every poem where you work through it, and the reader experiences that idea, right, they have experienced the equivalent of an axiomatic revolutionary discovery in physical science. Because the same act of creativity has been followed through to its conclusion. So in a sense of how do you train a cadre of geniuses in physical science? Get them to read Shakespeare. That's a good way. Shelley, Keats, right, Schiller. Because it, as Shelley says in A Defense of Poetry, right, the poetry is to creativity as exercise is to the body. Right, that by experiencing poetry, and whether it's poetry can also be prose, right? We're also talking about Beethoven and Mozart and all this stuff, right? Shelley doesn't define poetry as merely verse, right, of a certain type, right? But anything which comprises classical art, right, has this quality of increasing the power of creativity within the individual. So we can go on to the next slide, actually.
I don't want to move on to that.
Hmm?
Of course, you've read Ode to a Grecian Muse.
Mm-hmm.
But in that, like, you think, like, that, I think that's one of the best examples, because you're looking at the way in which that Shelley's communicating how he's experiencing this particular, like, now extinct art form.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read that poem and you actually dissect it, you actually look at it. Mm-hmm. Find meaning in it, and then you actually get to see a real Grecian urn,
mm-hmm.
art gallery, whatever. If you're lucky enough, you always have this thought object of the way in which Shelley was looking at it. And
mm-hmm.
again, he was in a sense taking the idea of trying to revive something as beautiful as that that is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's specific examples like that are being expressed throughout history that really would, if people were educated in that kind of thing, which is completely changes your appreciation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is it. The fact that you can communicate across the millennia, right? And you think of the implications of that for this question of human nature.
Think of it another 1,000 years when those Grecian men stood up.
And Keats's poem. So, I mean, poetry, in a sense, again, as Shelley says, is the root and the flower of culture, right? The seed and the fruit of language. And you think you don't have language without poetry, right? A language becomes dead when there are no more poets, right? The fact that our ability to express ideas is fundamentally based upon metaphor and the development of and the further increase in the power of the language to express ideas, which is a function of poetry. Mm-hmm.
Can you say, can you repeat, what you said about the seed? And
yes.
Also, poetry is to the mind, as it says, is to the body?
Yeah, poetry is to the mind, or poetry is to our creativity, as exercise is to the body.
Yeah.
Right, because maybe, because people might say, well, yeah, but I'm not going to, you know, reading these poems, this doesn't bring the bread home, right? But the thing is, you know, the fact that engaging in poetry is actually going to increase your capability to think.
Produce more bread.
Exactly. Figure out ways to produce more bread.
Better bread.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry is the seed in the language.
Yeah, poetry is the root and flower, right? The seed and the fruit of language and culture. Right, it's not only, so in a sense, think dynamically, right? Where it's the basis of the language, and it's also the production of the language, the produce of the language and the culture. Right, where the potential that the language has to express ideas is based upon the poetic development of the language. Right, and that language and what's done with it by the contemporary poets, right, is going to either increase or decrease that potential to express ideas.
Interesting, right. Thing about that, if you look at different languages, like, mm-hmm. Do you know I'm just from
German? No, I didn't. I'm
Christian. Okay, well, like, we were having a discussion the other day with this guy, he's a German translator, and he was, like, telling me in Lucas, like, the fact that there's, you know, like, 22,000 idiomatics in the German language. Mm.
Idiomatics,
the idea of, like, multiple meanings for words.
Oh, okay.
Say, feeling, mood,
yeah.
Different things like that. There's mm-hmm. 22,000. In the English language, there's 2,000. We have 2,000 in the idiomatic. So if you're learning something like a language like German, you cannot learn just literal speak. You will not be able to actually communicate mm-hmm. an idea to someone who literal speak. But you look at that, and you look at the type of rich history of Germany.
Yeah.
You look at, like, the history of the English language without your people. So if you're, in sense, English speakers, mm-hmm. people like Shakespeare and whatnot, people have talked about
mm-hmm.
when you look at the actual multitude of the type of poets and intellectuals that have come out of Germany,
mm-hmm. Yeah, the real fluorescence, yeah.
The development of the language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's a absolute relationship between the language and the poets that are being generated by that language, right? And the ability of that culture to discover principles of science.
Yeah.
Right? Because how do you communicate without a living, vibrant, and highly metaphorical language? Like, when Lynn talks about the fact that the subjunctive is being eliminated from the English language, right, that what he's talking about is the capability to express ambiguities and to shade the language. Right, like, in music, the capability to flatten or sharpen this question of modality that Lynn talks about. It's the same thing in language. The subjunctive takes up that capacity, right? To also form more complex thoughts and sentences, right? The subjunctive is key. So if you want to get people stupid,
get them reading AU couches.
Exactly. And then, yeah. And the idea of idioms, right? They come from poetry, again, and in the principles of poetry. Where these idioms begin as metaphors that are introduced on the part of poets, various writers, Well, Lin's a poet, right, for example. I mean, you see him using language in new ways quite often in his papers.
Even Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Dante, the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, so you see this, and what happens is these idioms become so common, or these phrases, these thoughts become so commonplace, right? They take on the quality of idioms, where it becomes so ingrained in the language, right? It becomes a part of it, like just a normal part, where we don't even think about it, the implications of where these come from. Just like we generally don't think about the implications of the fact that we use metaphors all the time. Right, we don't think about the implications for creativity and what it means about and the implications for humankind, right, and the nature of man. Right, so this quality of poetry being able to increase our creative potential is massive, right? And the fact that that classical composition will do this, whereas other forms will not, right? There's a reason that the CCF, well, since the end of World War II, promoted certain kinds of poetry, certain kinds of music, certain kinds of culture, as opposed to others. Right? Yeah. Now, the other great thing, great power of that poetry possesses, Schiller talks about this in... he has an essay, Drama as an Institution... Theater as a Moral Institution. Right, this idea that poetry represents the greatest moralizing force that mankind possesses in its various forms. Right, because what I talked about earlier, this question of the Imago Viva Dei, right, that we have a quote to read here at the end from Shelley's...
I was going to say, surely not more than music.
Well, is music not a form of poetry?
Yeah.
The only way to better that poem is to compose a 90-minute symphony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's it's another form, yeah. Yeah, because what you're talking about is really poetry as, like I said at the beginning, the expression of the imagination, right, as the most general sense of what it is, right, based upon lawful principles of that expression, in terms of classical composition.
Well, true classical artistic composition, in whatever form, allows the subject or participant to participate in this idea of the humanity or eternity,
mm-hmm.
to actually participate in this idea of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what any good classical art will do, whether it's in a form of music, drama, or poetry, which all three actually come together in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
You think about the idea of an opera, where it actually brings together all three forms of poetry, music, and drama,
mm-hmm.
to communicate ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what this act causes, right, is this question of universality, as we said, immortality and eternity, right, is to actually cast the reader or the poet beyond themselves, right, in a great act of love, right, because creativity by its nature is an act of love. Like Cheney's not creative, right? And if he was, it was by accident, and we see the results, right? It's So this is the thing. I mean, I want to flip a couple over because there's a... Hey, Val? There's a quote I'd like to read. Keep going there. Yeah, one more. I'll read this. This is a quote from Shelley's Defense of Poetry. If you haven't read it, I suggest very highly to read it. It's not that long. It's profound. The great secret of morals is love, or going out of our nature, and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful, which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another, and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. The great instrument of moral good, is the imagination, and poetry administers to the effect by acting upon the cause. Hence the Bach.
Hence the what?
Bach.
Bach.
Right. So, without further ado, I would like to go to the next. What time is it anyway?
20 past 10?
Nine. Well, alright. Got lots of time then. So, I have, since, you know, we ended with some Shelley here, there's a poem some of you have read before, with me we did. I used this last year in the class, but I think it's a wonderful piece, and it's, people when they think of Shelley, they think the Ode to the West Wind, or Ozymandias, right? So these kind of typical popular poems. What we have instead is a poem called Mont Blanc, which maybe some of you have read, but is an incredible piece that we're going to read now. So we can maybe form up to into a circle. And we want to consider all of the stuff that I've gone over, we've gone over, in terms of this composition and how to actually think about the reading of this piece now.